Hello, I'm Mark Govenden on Vectis Radio FM 104.6. We are chatting art, transport, communications history. That's CATCH. It's the Catchcast. And we're hoping to get you as fascinated by our wonderful geeky subjects as myself and the guests. In this edition, how one of Britain's most prolific lecturers and writers on industrial heritage is also a sports broadcaster. Today, we're joined by Richard Marks. Welcome to the Catchcast.
Hello, it's nice to be here.
Thank you so much for being here, Richard, and we'll speak in detail about your most recent books and lectures and maybe your sports coverage as well. But I wonder if we can start by taking you back to your upbringing and ask, how did you get so fascinated by our industrial heritage?
Do you know, it's all my grandfather's fault. He was a Yorkshire coal miner, and I used to go and spend a lot of time with him when I was growing up. And in the days when it was safe to put a seven-year-old on the train and send them from Berkshire up to Wakefield and then get looked after by the good old British Rail Guard and all the way up. So we used to sit and talk about mining by the fire when my grandmother had gone to bed. He took me to see Flying Scotsman at Sheffield when I was six. We went up and there was a photograph of me and him leaning out of the cab window, grinning like two very happy people. He actually took me around the mine that he used to work in. He'd retired by then. And we went and had a day just going and exploring the mine in the days when people would allow you to wander around these industrial centres without worrying about a seven-year-old wandering around a coal mine with a retired miner, because I guess they all knew him. But I guess these days you wouldn't get that opportunity. It was those kind of things that got me interested. And he took me to the North Yorkshire Moors Railway, my first exposure to heritage railways. And in the days again, when you used to be able to wander around the workshops, and he and I spent pretty much an afternoon wandering around the workshops. And that's kind of what set the seed, really. And then he gave me a Meccano set for my 8th birthday, and the rest is history.
That's such a nice story. But I understand your career took you into some other areas.
It did. So living in the Thames Valley and in the south of England, you kind of end up working in technology because it's everything that's around you and it's where you seem to end up. So that's kind of how I ended up working in business management software. Before then, I had worked in international trade and logistics and engineering, which happens a lot when you put these big management systems in. You have software companies then come calling because you've actually done it in anger, and then off you go into the tech world. And that's where I spent the majority of my career.
And were you able to spend any of your spare time looking at your favourite subject of industrial heritage?
I did. So one of the great things about the system engineering job was it meant being out on site quite a lot, because it means traveling. So I started adopting a policy of, rather than using the motorway service stations, I'd stop on the way. So frequent trips into things like the Great Central Railway at Loughborough, there's a nice loop off the M1 you can use. So I'd rather the heritage organisation. So I was going to the Mining Museum at Wakefield, anywhere just to go and get something to eat and a cup of tea, just because I'd rather they support them. So I started doing that. And then I eventually decided after a while that spending time sitting in airport departure lounges and various hotels, staring at televisions, trying to find something to read, or I could do something better with the time. So I signed up to do a bachelor's degree with the Open University and did that while I was working.
And then you went on to do a PhD as well, I believe.
I did. So I finished my bachelor's degree and signed up for a master's degree, which has got an interesting, funny tale to it as well. The graduation for the bachelor's degree, the vice chancellor of the Open University did a really, really good speech, but also an excellent sales job. And the amount of people that signed up that following Monday after the graduation on the Saturday for their master's programmes was quite amazing. It took me nearly a day to get through to the student kind of helpline, because there was a couple of questions I just wanted to check before I signed up. And it took me a day to get there. And the first thing that they said is, do you want to sign up for the master's program? Yes, how do you know? And apparently that's all they'd been doing all day from people that had graduated on Saturday. So great bit of salesmanship there. So I finished my master's degree and then I started a PhD. But I decided that rather than do it at the Open University, which I had talked to them about and I'd kind of approached them with what was involved. But I decided that I would rather be somewhere where I could actually go and sit with my supervisors. So I did my PhD at Reading. My PhD is basically economic history. So it looked at the relationship between railways and the industrialisation of rural counties in the 19th century. So it's two different perspectives on the source materials, where to go look.
Tell us about the impact of railways on industrial development in rural communities.
It's quite important. A lot that has been written and a lot that you'll see in the media and certainly in television is that there is a generalisation that gets used a lot, which says the railways caused economic growth and the railways turned up and everything was great, which is not strictly true. So it's the railways don't cause anything, but it won't happen if the railways aren't there. You could use the term catalyst rather than actually being responsible for it. So they allow things to happen. So in rural areas, it allows agriculture to mechanise. So you can buy farm machinery in from places like Ransom and Rapier in Ipswich, the big Barrett and Exall and Andrews agricultural machinery works and foundries in Reading, those kind of businesses, because you can get them there by rail. But it also means you have a bigger audience for your produce and a bigger audience for your products if you have a factory. So you end up with rural counties then getting split sort of into half. So you get East versus West Cornwall. So East Cornwall's very rural, very agricultural. West Cornwall becomes very industrial because of the tin and copper mining. Berkshire, you see the same. West Berkshire is very rural and very agricultural, and East Berkshire becomes quite industrialised. So you see that split in the two ends of counties quite frequently. You get North and South Yorkshire. You see it pretty much everywhere you look. What it means for the more rural areas is people can start to actually expand their businesses. They can buy product in. They can start exporting out of the counties and overseas as well, because you can get to places like Southampton and, you know, those kind of ports. It also means that people can start moving out of the big towns as we get towards the end of the 19th century, and the professions are starting to have their practices in more rural areas. So where you'll find an accounts practice, engineers, architects, those kind of people are moving out of the big cities because you can get to town. The real kind of difference is if you take somewhere like Reading, Reading to London, if you want to go and do business before the railway, it's a 3-day trip because it's going to take you 4 or 5 hours for the stagecoach to get there. You have, of course, got your mandatory toll to get through Maidenhead Thicket, which you have to give to Dick Turpin. And when you get to London, everyone's gone home because you're not getting there till 4 o'clock in the afternoon because the stagecoach doesn't leave till lunchtime. So you have to stay overnight. You do your business the following day. When you get back, the coaches have all left because they leave at lunchtime. It's another overnight stay. You get home maybe late afternoon on day three. The railway opens, and instead of being a 3-day trip, it's 40 minutes each way. Hmm. So you can get the 8 o'clock train. You're at Paddington by 9 o'clock at the latest. You're doing whatever you need to go in town, and you're home for tea. It's an absolute huge change.
Wow. We're speaking with economic historian Richard Marks, but I'm going to ask him, what does that actually mean? What does an economic historian do, Richard?
So what we do is we combine how economists and historians look at the world, and we're looking at business history and kind of social history, at how major events impact it, how changes in business procedures change things, and the interrelationship between things like railways, canals, transport infrastructure, businesses, the military, government, how it all kind of weaves together to change how society evolves over time. That's kind of what we do as economic historians. So it's kind of industrial history with everything else that impacts it as well. And that's what we do.
But I need to ask you, what is the connection, Richard, between football and war?
There's quite a lot going on. So the army are using football during the First World War as a recreational activity for the troops when they're out of the trenches. The perception of the First World War that the soldiers go out to France, they sit in the mud for 4 years and then they come home, hopefully, isn't actually true. They only spend a few days in the trenches unless there's a major offensive going on. So they have a lot of time outside the trenches in the rear areas and then in the reserve areas. And the army always has a problem of what do you do with soldiers when they're not actually training and they're not actually involved in operations, because a bored soldier is the nightmare of the local sergeant. So you give them something to do. And football's really easy. So you can set it up really easy. You just need a ball and some way of making goals. And being the army, you have access to the Royal Engineers. So no excuse for not being able to produce goals, I guess. And it's something that they do to keep the men exercised. It's good for fitness. It's a really good team building exercise. But they do things like they play matches with the troops wearing gas masks because it gets them used to the idea of wearing them, being comfortable with them without them actually realizing that's what they're doing, because of course they're concentrating on where the ball is and closing down an opposition. They do it as a way of building up camaraderie within a regiment, but also competition between battalions, other regiments, between the Royal Flying Corps, the Army, the Navy, those kind of things. But then you also have it happening at home. So the munitions work that's being done back in England, a lot is being done by either men who are reserved occupations or are unfit or too old to serve in the army, and a lot of women. And that's where women's football becomes really popular in the First World War, because there are whole leagues of what are called munitionettes teams. And some of them are very, very good. There is a team in Newcastle that go an entire season unbeaten and win that league. And they're getting big crowds. They're getting 20-odd thousand people turning up at places like Roker Park in Sunderland to go and watch these games. So it's really, really popular. There is a footballers' battalion as well. So professional footballers sign up together to go serve in the army and win these pals battalions where local people all sign up together. Later on, the army stopped doing that because it can have very bad consequences, particularly things like the first day of the Somme. Then the casualties are really high. You can have whole villages lose that entire age group because they are in those casualties. So they stopped doing that. But the footballers' battalion is one, and there are players from Arsenal and Reading and Tottenham Hotspur, Newcastle, Manchester City, Manchester United, you know, they're all there in signing up together to go serve. But the other thing that's interesting is you have regiments are kicking footballs ahead of an advance. And it happens at Loos particularly. And that football still exists, which is quite something. That was basically kicked across no man's land as the troops are actually advancing towards the German trenches. And they're all following the ball.
Wow. And you've turned all this into a bit of a blog, Richard.
I have. I wrote a blog for the Football and War Network, which I am actually involved with. I'm a member of the network. It's headquartered in the University of Wolverhampton. They provide the home for the network, and there are quite a few different people scattered all over the country that are involved in doing that. So I wrote a piece about how the First World War kind of happens as far as the British Army is concerned and how they organise and run it, and then how football forms into that kind of whole piece of how you keep the army functioning.
I mean, pretty fascinated by football and cricket as well, don't you? How does this manifest nowadays?
I do some work for hospital radio, so I do occasional live commentaries, but also match reports from football matches during the season.
Nice one. And coming back to your books, you produced a very large history of British Rail Engineering Limited, didn't you?
I did.
That's why BREL was so important to our railways.
It's formed in 1970, so it is British Rail's workshops. So in the late 60s, they decide that they're going to spin the workshops off, create a private company, transfer all of the staff and workshops to that company, which then means it can go looking for export business and business outside the railway, because the railway is restricted by law because of the Acts of Parliament that went into place to create the railway companies back in the 19th century to only making things for themselves. So they create this company, and it's supposed to be a private company. It is. It's privately listed. It's privately incorporated. The only thing is that British Rail Board own all the shares. It's kind of an arm's length company, but they own all of British Rail's workshops, and they make all of the trains for British Rail. They do a lot of innovation. They work with British Rail Research at Derby very closely, so they actually build everything for British Rail Research, and there are some very strange things that come out of British Rail Research, including the nuclear-powered spaceship. I jest not. There is a patent for it that is owned by British Rail.
No.
Yeah, it's quite strange when you start digging around and you think, you've done what? They're building lots of things. You've got the advanced passenger train, the high-speed trains. There is a freight locomotive that they design, which is designed to be an export locomotive, which is why it looks the way it looks, because it's designed to be modular so they can flex it depending on whether it's working on narrower gauges in Africa or it needs to be bigger for the United States or Canada, those kind of things. So it's quite an easy machine to flex. But they're also doing a lot of work for people like the army. So they are building armored personnel carrier bodies for the armored personnel carrier in the Scorpion tank series. They are all made at Wolverton workshops because they've got the jigs that are big enough and they're used to handling big sheets of high quality metals, in this case, aluminium armor plate, because they have the machinery to do it. So they do a lot of work for the MOD. But one of the most important things that they're doing is all of the innovation that comes out of BREL, and there is a lot.
Like the advanced passenger train, you mean?
Yes, absolutely. Which is one of those almost moments in history. There's absolutely nothing wrong with it. It's cancelled because it overruns and there are they have issues with it. But fundamentally, the design is absolutely solid. It's completely sound. It will work. And when it does work, it works incredibly well. The issue they've got is they are trying to push the 1970s technology too far, too fast. And they don't have the electronics to be able to get things like the tilt mechanism working properly. And there is a little bit of a pushback against it because people don't like the idea of tilting trains because they think they're unsafe because they've never been done before. Because the project starts to overrun, the Treasury starts asking questions of the British Rail Board as to why they're spending so much money. And British Rail Board sadly decide to kill the project. But of course that ultimately results in the Pendolino trains that run on the West Coast main line, which are pretty much the same design but with modern engineering, modern materials, modern composites, modern electronics,
and sadly not made by BREL though.
No, sadly not. BREL was privatized in the 1990s as part of the move towards the privatisation of British Rail. And it was sold off actually to a management buyout supported by Trafalgar House and Asea Brown Boveri, and then ABB buy out Trafalgar House and management after a while, and the Brown name disappears and various elements become parts of Bombardier, ABB, those kind of things. So the workshops are still there. So places like Derby Litchurch Lane, still there, still making trains, still doing everything that it always has done since the 19th century, but sadly no longer Braille.
But there was a more successful sister of the APT, wasn't there?
Yes, the high-speed train, or the Intercity 125, as you might be more familiar with it. That is very successful. And what they're doing with that and what British Rail Research are doing is taking the technology that's there and actually evolving it, rather than trying to be really groundbreaking and taking that huge leap forward that the advanced passenger train was. So they weren't joking when they used the word advanced. But the high-speed train is very successful simply because it's taking what they can do and pushing it further down the same route. So evolving it and developing it and cleaning everything up so that you can actually get more out of it. And also making it a fixed formation train, which saves time at each end. So that's why you have the power car at each end, a cabin each end. When it arrives at somewhere like Penzance or Edinburgh or wherever it's terminating its journey, then the driver's only got to walk down the other end, or another driver's got to come get down the other end, and off you go again without having to shunt stock and all the delays of those kind of things. So it's part of that move towards these fixed formation trains. And it's part of that kind of thinking of how do we just make things better, which actually results in a really interesting export coach as well that BREL develop at the same time, which is actually designed to be termite proof, because they're selling it to places where termites are going to be a problem because they're eating the woodwork of everything else that's being made. So they develop this termite proof coach, which is only, again, a development and an evolution of what they're already doing.
Crikey.
So it's quite clever stuff. But the high-speed train's a great piece of equipment. Of course, there's still the last few of them are still running around in Scotland and down in the southwest.
And, of course, that became sort of popularly known as the Intercity 125. So you've told us all about your first couple of books, but your writing seems to have gone into overdrive recently, and we'll hear more about the ones you're about to publish in a moment. But do tell us about the Wantage Tramway, Richard.
The Wantage Tramway is a really interesting company. So it's only 3 miles long, but it's an incredibly innovative company. They are the first steam-powered tramway in the world. The Act of Parliament doesn't actually let you run a tramway using steam power at the time, so the 1870 Tramways Act. So they couldn't run anything that wasn't animal-powered, except the Board of Trade let them run steam as an experiment because the Board of Trade want to go back to the House of Commons and get it amended. And so the whole tramway is an experiment in its own right, but they're using machinery that's coming from workshops and they're trialing it. Then after the trials, they buy the tram locomotives fairly cheaply. A lot of prototypes of what then ends up in places like New Zealand and France, that the Paris tramway is all steam trams. And the first one of those runs on the Wantage tramway as an experiment. So they're quite leading edge and they're really good at looking after the staff. They pay a dividend every year that they exist, other than the last couple. And the interesting thing is they are owned by local people. Every shareholder is from either Wantage or the towns and villages around it, which is really interesting and quite unusual.
Right. And your next release, or one of the ones that happened after that, I understand, is about a railway I've been lucky to travel on, the line to Swanage. It's billed as a new way of doing things, your study of sort of both the heritage railway and the history of the region. Tell us about how you developed this concept, please, Richard.
What the idea was is, rather than just a guidebook that says, here is some stuff, here is a station, here is the railway, I wanted to give visitors the opportunity to kind of understand why the railway is there and what the heritage is. So rather than just a ride on the train, it's a ride on a train with some meaning. So what are you seeing outside the window? So at Swanage, you're seeing a lot of Ball clay mines, and you're seeing the remnants of the narrow gauge railways that served them, which is also why the Swanage Railway was built. People going on holiday to Swanage, again, that's why Swanage Station is the size and shape it is. So I wanted to kind of give the visitor a bit more than just a guide to, here is the locomotive that's on the front of your train, and here's Corfe Castle Station, and oh, by the way, there's a castle. I wanted to kind of say why the castle is there, why the railway is there, how everything all works together, just to give you a bit more context and maybe a bit more of an enjoyable day out. And then also reasons to come back, reasons to stay longer. So exploring some of the heritage around the railway that you could either use the railway to get to, or you could stay longer. So places like Swanage, you've got Dorchester, you've got Poole and Bournemouth. You've got all of the great museums that are very close to the railway. There are many things that you could do that maybe you could do over a weekend and spend the weekend.
That is a lovely idea, because there's so many railway books out there, and some of them are, well, they're obviously put together by real fans of each railway, but you feel it's a bit kind of out of context, and you're reading about track lengths and bogies and that kind of thing. You think, well, just put it all a bit in context. So I'm glad you're doing that. You're also compiling some other works to celebrate the 200 years of railways, aren't you?
Yes, I am. Just finished both of those. So one is 200 years of railway locomotive design, and the other is 200 years of railway stations. So both, again, aimed to be a little bit different. So the locomotive book is more why than what. So it's why the railway companies and the engineers decided to go down the routes they did, why things don't work or why they do work, why certain arrangements, certain developments happen, and what they're for. So why your heavy freight locomotives look the way they do, and how that evolves from the very first ones on the Stockton and Darlington to the very last ones that are built by British Rail. And similar approach for the stations. So it's less about architecture, because that's been done quite a lot. So it's less about neoclassical and Gothic architecture as to why the stations are where they are, and why the railway companies are opting to use that big statement architecture at places like St Pancras and Edinburgh and Leeds, and why they're adopting the Art Deco movement in the late 20s and early 30s. So it's much more why, and why the stations are where they are and why they look the way they look, a study of railway architecture, because that's been done quite a lot. And there's been some very good television series recently that cover that quite nicely. So I wanted to kind of do something a little different that kind of filled that gap a little bit as to why.
Good. And a historian who really cares about doing things differently. I'm quite fascinated by the stations as well. How do you think the station platform environment differs in the UK to those seen in some other European countries?
There's a lot of similarities. They are designed to move a lot of people very quickly. Railway is a mass transit mechanism after all. So you end up with these very wide platforms. But again, you get that similarity of depends where you look. So the big stations in Munich and Berlin and Paris are very similar to the big stations in London and Birmingham in function. But then you have the differences then with the way the railway operates. So, and particularly you see it in the United States as well, you have very, very low platforms. Whereas in Britain, you have a lot higher platforms, which make boarding and leaving the trains mostly a lot easier. One or two trains are now getting a bit taller, so we now have the issue with platforms maybe being a step down, but easier to get onto and on and off, rather than the US and some European countries where you do have to climb the steps to get into the train, which makes them perhaps not so accessible where those facilities aren't available. But function-wise, places like St Pancras and the old Birmingham New Street before British Rail developed it, and the big city stations, Bristol Temple Meads, very similar to places like Grand Central in New York. Big open spaces, big concourses, big statement buildings. So there's a lot of similarities, and then you get into the ways that each country is approaching building its railway network and how that then knits together. And then you have the differences with things like the German railways having been built by the states before unification. So the Bavarian and Saxon railways are very much built in the Bavarian and Saxon style, whereas the railways in Britain and the United States are very much more independent companies built by individuals or individual groups, so they have their own flavours. So there's a lot of differences and similarities, but also the differences are because of the similarities in the railways are built, which is interesting.
Yeah, exactly. I was thinking particularly about sort of platform height, because that is so obvious when you go to other countries. Can we move on to some of your most recent work? I know that you deliver lectures in the subjects we've covered today, but you also run things like workshops and courses. How does all that work?
Yeah, I do talks for various groups. So pretty much anybody really that has an interest in any of the subjects that I cover. I do run workshops, so I do a lot of work for family history societies and history groups where I might run two or three sessions. I do some stuff online as well for a couple of organisations where I've just done three sessions on Railway 200, and I'm doing another one, which is two sessions on military medicine, which is another area I did in my degree, was history of medicine, so I cover that too. So I'm doing two sessions up to the First World War and after the First World War on military medicine. And I also teach at university as well, and I'm running a course this semester on Victorian railways, and I teach on the Diploma in Local and Social History of Littler too.
Crikey.
So all sorts.
You really do fit so much into your days, Richard. It's been absolutely fascinating talking with a fellow railway enthusiast, writer, lecturer and broadcaster, and I hope you've enjoyed listening to this as much as I have. Thanks so much for joining us, Richard.
It's an absolute pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, you can find Richard's books on your usual search engine or bookshop, and you can also read more about him and even book him to give a lecture at industrypast.co.uk. Next week's Catchcast is not to be missed. We're doing more chatting art transport communications history. Please do join us then.